Pushkin.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you, who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A. member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Co.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Some people are squeezing their way in between the stones. So there's people who are standing very quietly. There's somebody who's doing kind of calisthenic movements. Little hint of marijuana on the air.
Bring forth new opportunities and beginnings.
One equinox, I came to see the sunrise at Stonehenge. Every time someone says Stonehenge in a documentary, or at least the first time, there has to be a cosmic chord. Don't complain to me about it. I don't make the rules.
I think I can hear somebody with a temple gong or a singing bowl or something like that.
On the equinox, day and night are of almost equal lengths. So I've come to see the sunrise at Stonehenge.
Let's go find where the tones are coming from.
These days, you can't get very near the stones out on the middle of Salisbury Plain. Visitors are kept at a distance to avoid damage. But British pagans say this site is crucial for their faith. In the past, they've even fought police to get access to the stones. So finally, the body that manages the site, English Heritage, agreed that on 4 days a year, people could be allowed to worship here. This is one of those mornings.
Thee we invoke, O light of life.
Thee we invoke, O powers of life.
Be thou a bright flame before us.
Be thou a bright flame before us.
There's a crowd here, pretty much what you'd expect if you've ever hung around the British Free Festival scene. There are robes and staffs and garlands of flowers.
Kindle thou within our hearts.
Kindle thou within our hearts.
A flame of love to our neighbours.
The head druid is a benevolent-looking fellow with a white beard and a battered Panama hat.
To our friends, to our foes, to our kindred and all.
If you grew up in England like I did, then Stonehenge is a powerful national symbol. But it's not a castle or a cathedral or a stately home. It doesn't quite fit into official British history. The story dominated by the rich and powerful.
And as much welly as he possibly can, so the stones really do sing with us. Ladies and gentlemen.
Amen.
Something about Stonehenge leads people to think about great mysteries, about cosmic energy and aliens and lost civilizations. You could say it's come to symbolize mystery itself, the possibility that our ancestors held secrets, and if only we could unlock them, we'd find out the truth about ourselves. I came to Stonehenge with a question in my mind, a whispering voice. Do the stones belong to me? My mother's English, but my father came to England from India. Stonehenge is a symbol of continuity, of a people who've been here, as the phrase goes, since time immemorial. So is Stonehenge part of my heritage? Could I be a druid too? This is Into the Zone, a show about opposites and how borders are never as clear as we think. My name's Hari Kunzru. I'm a fiction writer, the kind who likes to research things, and I've always wanted a chance to explore some of the true stories I've discovered, stories that are often stranger and more affecting than fiction. In this season, I'll be finding out what it was like to be a punk behind the Iron Curtain. I'll meet the inventor of the MP3. I'll investigate spiritualism and aliens and country music. The zones between life and death, public and private, east and west, signal and noise, black and white. I want to know, why do we divide up the world in these ways? In this first episode, that division is personal. It's all about natives and migrants. All my life, I felt like I exist between places, in a grey zone. I'm a novelist, and these days I live in Brooklyn. But I grew up just where the East End of London fades out into the county of Essex. Essex is, how to explain Essex, it has kind of a reputation.
A girl, you went to a girl and said to the girl, Joey's a little boy.
Look, if you f***ing whack me up right now.
I can actually understand what they're saying. That's the Estuarian accent, named for the place downriver from London. This accent is totally different from a London accent, and if I listen to it for too long, I start talking that way. Essex was my home until the age of 18. Essex was where I grew up during the Thatcher years. Essex boys and girls with their flashy clothes and bad manners are the bridge and tunnel crowd of London. There's a whole genre of Essex girl jokes. How does an Essex girl turn the lights on after sex? She opens the car door. Essex girl's dad is Essex man, an old British political archetype used by pollsters as a shorthand for a particular kind of right-leaning voter, someone from a working-class background who made money and moved to the suburbs. In the 80s, Essex man brought Margaret Thatcher to power. In the 2016 Brexit referendum about whether Britain should stay in the European Union, every single district in the county of Essex voted to leave. Essex, to me, is dancing to electro music at Illusions under-18s nightclub in Epping. It's being chased through a subway underpass by the neo-Nazi Chingford Skins. It's the statue of Winston Churchill on Woodford Green, looking on as the local team plays cricket. It's 17-year-old boys wrapping cars around trees and having gang fights on the golf course with sharpened umbrellas. That's my English heritage. It's complicated. And now that I live in America, I don't usually get to talk about it.
Great.
But recently, I went to see an old school friend called Shop Malik.
An old friend.
Someone I haven't seen since I left Essex.
Hello.
Good Lord, Harry, how are you doing?
30 years on.
Has it really been? Yes, it could have been.
I think
it's a bit scary.
That's really scary.
I'm actually still in touch with a fair number of people from...
Notice he says Harry, like the prince. My name's pronounced Hurry. Shop's given name is actually spelt S-W-A-P-A-N, and for years he let people mispronounce it, Swapan. Shop and I were close friends for a while, mostly when we were very young.
Really have changed. I was trying to imagine how you would be, and then, you know, 30 years is a long time.
Well, we've both got, like, slightly less hair than before.
No, I was bald at school.
Were you already? I remember you had very short hair. I mean, I think my hair all fell out because I had that phase of gelling it all vertically. I mean, I was trying to have that sort of high-top fade that no one had explained to me that you couldn't do with Indian hair.
Hair. It was always a problem for me as a teenager. Once I tried to dye mine blonde to be more like the casuals who I was trying to emulate, the boys who dressed in Italian sportswear, Fila tracksuits and Diadora gold sneakers. These boys had older brothers who ran with football gangs, the Gooners or the Intercity firm. I didn't, and even the ultimate casual hairstyle, a curly wet-look perm, wasn't going to fix that. Anyway, in my late 20s, my hairline started to recede and I decided to shave my head. And to be honest, it was a relief. All in all, I had better hair luck than my old friend Shop Malik. But we did have something else in common. Something else that no amount of hair gel was going to change. We were brown. Two of the only Asian kids in our very white Essex world. We were, to use the insult that dogged us every day, Packies.
I wanted to ask you about a personal memory that I have. I don't know which year it was. I guess we might have been 8 or 9 or something like that.
I'll tell you the truth. I didn't run into Shop by accident. I'd taken a train to Boston to talk to him. Mainly it was to find out about his work at Harvard Medical School, which I'll get to in a moment. But also it was because he'd got out of Essex, like I had, and gone far, far away. I wanted in particular to see if he remembered something. Something that happened when we were very young.
It was your birthday, and your parents took us to the cinema. I remember us getting off at Trafalgar Square, straight into a National Front rally.
The National Front was and is a violent far-right organisation which campaigned for an end to immigration. Back in the 80s, NF members used to be everywhere. These big skinhead guys in bomber jackets and 16-hole Doc Marten boots telling you to go home. As a little kid, I found them terrifying.
Some policemen basically came and immediately kind of took us away, and they were very concerned because we were a little gang of brown people.
So it's interesting that you remember it. For me, all I remember from England was that generally it was a very racist place and that was the norm. It would not have been surprising to me that, you know, you could get beaten up fairly regularly for no reason at all except for the colour of your skin. I don't know about you, but I never dared go to a football match because I would be putting my life.
I talk about this to people now who ask what football team I support, and I have to explain to them that it was not safe for me to go to a football game when I was growing up. And so why on earth would I be interested in a sport where I couldn't even attend as a spectator?
So the amazing thing to me is that that was normal. Racism was just everywhere and it was a normal thing. And I don't know about you, but I just tended to ignore it and just get on with the things I was trying to do. And perhaps even more scary is that for me, I just accepted it.
He's right. I just accepted it too. But Shop couldn't remember the incident of his birthday party, the incident that had been on my mind for 30 years. I distinctly remember the Union Jacks in the distance around the base of Nelson's Column. Shop's dad in a suit and tie, his mum's bottle green sari, the police whisking us out of trouble. Talking to Shop did confirm some things for me. Over the years, I tried to explain to people how it was back then. When you repeat something, turn it into a story, it can start to feel a bit hollow. Since making up stories is what I do for a living, I could start to wonder, was I exaggerating about Essex? No.
I was never, ever allowed to forget that I was a Packie.
Yep. And I don't know about you, but my solution to try and deal with this was to live as happy a life as I could. And when I met racist people, my favourite thing to do was to try and make them laugh. If you made them laugh at something, they would see you in a different light, and I would like to cause that confusion in them because I felt they were wrong.
These days we have a language for it. All the little things, the insults and the jokes. The stuff that cumulatively wears you down and serves to remind you of your low status. We call them microaggressions. And here I'd like to emphasise the micro. Things felt bad, but they could have been worse. No one was spray-painting slurs on our house or putting dog feces through our letterbox. Those things did happen to a friend of mine who grew up in Leicester. And I have some happy memories, mostly to do with escaping into books and music. I was a big science fiction fan. I read a lot of weird stuff, mostly in old 1960s paperbacks that I found in charity shops. I remember reading Erich von Däniken, a Swiss writer who proposed that in ancient times, aliens had visited Earth and helped people build monuments. Stonehenge, he said, was a model of the solar system, built as a sort of road sign for passing spaceships, letting them know that there was intelligent life on the planet. I wanted that to be true when I visited Stonehenge as a kid. And today, to be honest, if there were any spaceships passing by, I wanted them to take me with them. Back on Earth, a question that always made me anxious was, where are you from? Often I didn't feel like trotting out the complicated story of my Indian dad's migration to the mother country, or how he met my English mum, and why I came to find myself a child in Essex rather than Kashmir. I wanted to be like everyone else, to be from here, like white people were. The ones whose ancestors went back thousands of years. People who erected stones in a mysterious circle. People who had a home. I didn't know yet that this idea of an ancestral homeland was, as we say in Essex, total bollocks.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at tmobile.com/now.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global. Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
A while ago, I heard about a book called Who We Are and How We Got Here. The book is by David Reich, who runs a lab dedicated to analysing DNA samples from ancient human remains. Reich is one of the pioneers of this kind of science. It's a completely new field, less than 10 years old. In 2010, the first five ancient human genomes were published. It started as a trickle of genetic data, but it soon became a fire hose. In 2014, 38 genomes were published. By August 2017, one lab, David Reich's, had generated data for more than 3,000 samples. In 7 years, we'd gone from nothing to detailed portraits of thousands of ancient people. This mass of new data is allowing scientists to uncover all sorts of information about ancient humans, our ancestors. They discovered that farming had developed in the Near East more than 10,000 years ago, and not in a single place, but among several different human populations. They discovered that the humans who spread into remote Pacific islands around 3,000 years ago were not the sole ancestors of the present-day inhabitants, which is a very weird story indeed, but one for another time. These scientists even discovered a whole new species of archaic hominid. A quarter of a million years ago, it wasn't just us and Neanderthals. There was a third population, the Denisovans. Their existence was completely unknown before the rise of this new kind of genetic archaeology. Right now, migration is portrayed as an existential threat to settled people. And so reading Who We Are and How We Got Here felt oddly hopeful to me. The book seemed to be opening up another kind of history, one in which human populations are always moving and changing. In this history, movement and change aren't modern phenomena, and they aren't evidence of collapse or decline. In this way of understanding history, it's migrants all the way down.
So I'm not a statistician. Right. My background is mathematics.
And guess who works at Reich's lab at Harvard? My friend from Essex, Shop Malik.
I'm now an informatician, although I'm moving now more towards the population genetics side of things.
Back when we were kids, Shop was the class clown. Now he's a physicist who uses terms like coalescent simulations and proboscidean in ordinary conversation. I can't even say that. Shop is the bioinformatics director of David Reich's lab, where he writes software that sorts billions of DNA sequences and creates an easily accessible database. It made me happy to find out what he'd done with his life, to discover that he was co-authoring papers in the journal Nature, working on important science.
And so we're trying to make a public repository of the world's ancient data. And we generate, more than 50% of the world's ancient human samples now?
Yeah.
And in addition to that, we bring in all the external samples we can, and we're trying to agglomerate them into one giant portal that's available to anyone.
The other voice you're hearing is David Reich. After I got reacquainted with Shop, Reich gave me a tour of their lab.
Okay, there's not so much to see because you're not allowed to go into the most interesting places.
Oh.
We have two clean rooms.
Like any good lab, this one is a kind of machine for generating data. You could think of Reich and his team as early oil prospectors, capering with glee by the side of a gusher. The stuff is coming out faster than they can deal with it. But like old-time oil prospectors, they've had to work hard to make their fortunes.
As part of your problem, the technical challenge of this is that the proportion of the DNA that's present in these samples, that's the DNA you want, that's actually from the humans, is very, very small, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a miracle there's any at all. So there's tens, hundreds of thousands of times, millions of times less DNA per gram than there was when the person was alive.
And where does the other DNA come from?
A lot of the DNA that's there is usually mostly microbial from bacteria and fungi that colonize the bone after the individual died. But also it's a dead, it's just not living bone anymore. And so the DNA is degraded, it's shattered, it's fragmented, it's been eaten over time. It's DNA is an amazingly stable molecule, and it's really amazing that it's still around.
What David Reich and his team have done is incredibly complicated, but it's actually a stack of small steps. And it's as much about practical problem solving as it is about some eureka moment where a dude writes a lot of equations on a whiteboard. A lot of it is about industrialization, about taking time-consuming methods and automating them. This has revolutionized how we think about the past, but it's a revolution that snuck up on everyone. Reich used to work in a lab run by a Swedish scientist called Svante Paabo at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig. At Paabo's lab, they were trying to extract DNA from a 40,000-year-old human bone found in a cave in China. Even with a lot of computing power and all the armory of modern lab equipment, it was just too expensive to sequence the whole messy lot and search through it for the tiny traces of human DNA. How they solved this problem is, I think, incredibly cool. In the 1990s, biologists had learned how to do something very smart, how to use laser etching techniques invented for printing electronic circuits to attach millions of DNA fragments to silicon or glass wafers. David Reich describes it as an array of fish hooks. Since DNA likes to bind to similar sequences, if you bait your hooks the right way, you can fish in a soup of ancient bone DNA for what you want. Reich saw the potential in this technique. He and his collaborator Nadine Rowland adapted it so they could fish out not just one chromosome, but the whole genome. In itself, that would have been impressive. But then they hired a team of technicians to grind bones, and they began fishing using robots which could prepare 96 samples at a time. And this is when the gusher of data began to flow. When you have a lot of samples, suddenly you can make comparisons and statistical inferences that simply weren't possible before. You can start to tell stories not just about one or two ancient individuals, but about whole populations.
It's a completely different thing to be able to go back in time and actually with a time machine and see what happened rather than to try to piece it together from the circumstantial evidence that's left behind.
The Harvard team has made all kinds of discoveries, and they've had an impact on the way archaeologists think about prehistory in almost every part of the world. But for me, there's one huge insight, and it has to do with race. Or more specifically, Northern Europeans. You know, white people. Our idea of race is largely an invention of the 18th century. Since then, we've assumed that there are a few basic primal races, African, Caucasian, Asian, and so on. People used to claim that these races had always been separate, even that they were separate species. And lately, the story has been that after some kind of fuzzy out-of-Africa business, people settled in various parts of the world, separated out, and gradually became different as they adapted to their various environments. Only when these so-called pure races met and mixed did you get people like me. There are purity fetishists all over the world. I speak as the descendant of high-caste Hindu men who wouldn't touch anyone of a lower caste or even travel by sea in case they were polluted by what they called the black water. But if you're of Northern European descent and secretly like to think of yourself as pure Aryan or some such thing, then David Reich and Shot Malik and the rest of the ancient genetics community would like a word with you. They recently dropped a bombshell in a paper innocuously titled Genomic Insights into the Origin of Farming in the Ancient Near East.
We computed squared allele frequency differentiation between all pairs of ancient West Eurasians.
What this paper is saying is that around 10,000 years ago, there were four different populations in Europe, and that these four populations were as different from each other as modern Europeans are from modern Chinese.
Comparable to the value of 0.09 through 0.13 seen between present-day West Eurasians.
So just by eyeballing people, you'd be able to identify the four different groups. You'd probably think of them as races. You'd see hunter-gatherers with dark skin and blue eyes. You'd see farmers with light skin, dark hair and brown eyes, and then there were other different dark-skinned farmers. You'd also see migrants from far to the east with startling blonde hair. Then, over time, these populations mixed. And by the Bronze Age, those four races had disappeared. Western Europeans began to look like they do today. We have a huge racial vocabulary for mixed people, mostly dating to the era of the Atlantic slave trade. Mestizo, mulatto, métis, half-caste, creole, octoroon, quadroon, all words describing the blending of two ingredients in some particular proportion, pure white and something else. The phrase older people used for me when I was growing up was a touch of the tar brush. What David Reich's research tells us is that the people we colloquially call white are not, quote-unquote, pure. They're a hybrid population that didn't exist a few thousand years ago. I'll say that again. White people didn't exist a few thousand years ago. Calling yourself white isn't a statement about your basic biology. It's a statement about politics. Perhaps you're listening to this and you're not white. Perhaps you're thinking, ha-ha, white people are a new invention. I, on the other hand, come from an ancient folk whose wisdom gave us the pyramids, or the Rig Veda, or whatever.
No. So I think there's an idea that we have that intuitively that we learned from our childhood, because our cultural memory is actually very shallow, that the population structure we see around us today is somehow a reflection of something that's very age-old, that goes back not just thousands, but maybe tens of thousands, or even in some people's minds, even longer years, reflecting the population structure we see around us today.
Maybe even as far back as the Druids at Stonehenge.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global. Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
It's the only credible and negotiable plan on the table.
I'm back in England.
No hard border in Northern Ireland.
And the only news on the radio is about when or how the UK will leave the European Union.
Just as the UK has evolved its position, the EU will need to evolve its position too.
Brexit is the biggest upheaval in national identity in my lifetime. All my friends seem depressed, uncertain about the future. I start my day in Peckham in South London as I step through the gate into the quadrangle of what was once an almshouse. It's a miniature version of an Oxford or Cambridge college, a square closed in on itself, one of those semi-secret places that exist in London. It's an entirely appropriate setting to find the lair of a historian, someone who can tell me more about the Druids.
I'm Rosemary Hill. I am an independent scholar and researcher. And my subject, insofar as I have one, is history, but the history of objects in relation to abstract ideas.
And how did you come to be interested in Stonehenge?
Sorry? I was saying...
And how did you come to be interested in Stonehenge, a large object?
A very large object. Well, who isn't interested in Stonehenge? And I was interested really because of the ideas that it's attracted. I'm interested in what people have thought about it. And I'm also interested in the many hundreds of years when no one thought anything about it.
Rosemary Hill says that for a long time, no one cared very much about Stonehenge. People thought it might be a natural formation or a failed attempt at a building. It looked nothing like the beautiful temples of ancient Greece and Rome. Then, in the 17th century, a scholar named John Aubrey took a closer look. Aubrey was one of Britain's first archaeologists. To him, Stonehenge had clearly been made for a reason.
I mean, Aubrey was the first person really to think about prehistory, the idea that there was something before we had any records. And in a moment of absence of mind, of which Aubrey had many, he referred to it having been druidic. Because the only people who anyone had ever referred to as living in Britain before the Romans were the Druids. And it was really a slightly throwaway remark. But William Stukeley, who was the next great antiquary to approach Stonehenge, took up the Druids with tremendous force and really very largely made them into what they are now.
Ah, yes, the Druids. The problem with the Druids is they didn't actually appear until thousands of years after Stonehenge was built.
One of the things that always interests me is that if people, enough people, believe something for long enough, it will happen. And so many people for so long believed that there were Druids at Stonehenge that in the course of time, Druids appeared at Stonehenge.
Why? Because Druids became fashionable. In the 18th century, there was a full-scale Druidic revival. Gentlemen set up Druidic societies in England, a bit like the Freemasons, but with more drinking and medal ceremonies. Also, a lot of horrible infighting. But gradually, the roistering Druids discovered their mystical side.
They become interested in a spiritual view of the world, in a pagan kind of religion. Though I don't think at the beginning they would care to be called pagans. They were associated at various points with Wicca, which was the only religion ever to have been founded in England. And, of course, as time went on and the increasing clamour for Stonehenge to become a public monument, once it became public, then all the controversy really boiled over. That was when the actual fighting started at Stonehenge over who should own it.
When Rosemary says fighting, she means it. Actual fighting.
The convoy of 150 trucks, coaches and caravans moved off shortly after midday to drive to Stonehenge in defiance of the law.
For at least a century, Stonehenge has been the scene of violent confrontations between the forces of order and those who want to celebrate pagan rituals inside the stone circle. In the years before the First World War, there were riotous scenes involving mystics calling themselves the Universal Bond of the Sons of Men. On the solstice in 1925, 1,000 angry druids stormed the newly erected fence. Since then, Stonehenge has become a beacon for all those opposed to the state. In 1985, police set up roadblocks around Stonehenge to stop a convoy of what the press used to call New Age travellers. Officers attacked the convoy's vehicles with extreme violence, smashing windows and hitting people with truncheons, including pregnant women and mothers with babies in arms.
See what they're doing to us!
...537 travellers were eventually arrested, in one of the largest mass arrests since the Second World War. So who does Stonehenge belong to? The state or the people? And if it's the people, then which people?
That feels amazing. That really does. That feels awesome. You're finding it difficult, yeah?
Can I just ask, what were you doing there? We're making a radio documentary about the stones.
Well, what was I doing?
Yeah, what was
I was feeling the vibrations going through the stones and then bringing them into myself, as vibrational energy changes you, as everything is vibration.
How does that make you feel?
Absolutely amazing.
The other voice you're hearing there is Will, my producer. He's come along with me to Stonehenge on my Equinox mission. We're wandering among the stones, waiting for the sun to rise. We found a guy with a didgeridoo, blowing it in between two of the upright stones, as his friend sticks her head in the gap to listen. The didgeridooist is dressed in what I'd call a sort of rustic Inca outfit, a poncho and a hat with flowers on it. His friend is wearing a cloak and has a crown of blossoms in her hair. She's one part village barmaid, one part elven princess.
But you need to be able to tune yourself into the vibrations and the frequencies in order to then get the benefit from it. He knows what I'm on about.
just trying to find like a natural pitch in here. If you stand and say Om to me.
Om.
You say Om as well. Om. You will try and hit the same key. Did you hear that kind of resonance when all the frequencies met at the same point? That's right. What I'm trying
the
to get in between.
The stones resonate there. The frequencies. So when you produce good frequencies, that produces good energies within you, and it's increased and multiplied by the stones, yeah? So that we can then share it with others.
She has a lot to say about frequencies. And she and her friend both have birthdays around Christmas, which is nice. But mainly, she wants us to know about the frequencies.
And there's different frequencies, yeah? And they have different impacts upon the human body. And certain ones healing, certain ones give you higher levels of consciousness, certain ones even do DNA repair.
If you want a good sound check, stick your microphone in here. I'm trying to hit a frequency of 10K.
Let's try this again.
As I walk around the stones on the equinox, David Reich's DNA science is on my mind, a sort of secret, eating away at me.
Thee we invoke, O light of life.
Thee we invoke, O powers of life.
Be thou a bright flame.
What that science has to say is troubling to both the official national culture and the counterculture that venerates these stones. For more than a century, archaeologists have traced the spread of a particular kind of ancient pottery across Europe, a distinctive drinking vessel in the shape of a bell. The record shows these bell beakers made their way to the British Isles just after the time that Stonehenge was built.
To our friends, to our foes, to our kindred all.
To our friends, to our foes, to our kindred all.
British archaeologists have argued for decades about whether bell beaker artefacts signal just a type of knowledge or the arrival of a new people. David Reich's genetic analysis gives a definitive answer. Reich shows that the bell beakers were brought to the island by new people, immigrants. You might even call it an invasion. Within a few generations, the Neolithic farmers who built Stonehenge were almost completely replaced. And modern-day Britons descend from the invaders, not the builders. It wasn't our ancestors who built Britain's great Stone Age monument 5,000 years ago. It was someone else entirely. Outrage could well be the quintessential British emotion. Certainly, it's the one that seems to give us the most pleasure. It's the defining emotion of Brexit. Outrage at foreigners, trying to make us fit in with their foreign ways. Inevitably, it defined coverage of the Bell Beaker discovery made by David Reich's lab. The headline in the Daily Telegraph: "No one living in Britain truly British, scientists find, as Stonehenge builders were replaced by European immigrants." But who were those builders of Stonehenge? The ones who raised the stones and were then displaced? Sure enough, ancient DNA research has given us this answer too. David Reich and my friend Shot Malik are credited as co-authors of a paper titled "Ancient Genomes Indicate Population Replacement in Neolithic Britain." It shows that before the Bell Beaker folk, early farming people migrated out of Anatolia around 6000 BC. That's Anatolia as in Turkey.
And now Mrs. Merkel has decided that Turkey must become a member of the European Union by 2025 at the latest. So if you vote to remain, ladies and gentlemen, you're voting to go into a political union with Turkey.
That's Nigel Farage, leader of the Brexit Party. He's trying to persuade his audience to vote to leave the EU by scaremongering about Turks being able to come and live in Britain. But if you pay attention to ancient DNA research, it looks like Farage is about 6,000 years too late. And it gets worse for him and his xenophobic crew. David and Shop's paper concludes that "we also infer considerable variation in pigmentation levels in Europe." Yes, you did hear that right. Variation in pigmentation levels. It's a polite way of telling the reader that some Neolithic Europeans had dark skin. Black and white are just clusters of traits, snapshots of genetic drift. At the 2019 Tory Party conference, the Home Secretary banged on a familiar nationalist drum.
As Home Secretary, at this defining moment in our country's history, I have a particular responsibility when it comes to taking back control. It is to end the free movement of people once and for all.
The Home Secretary, who wants to end the free movement of people once and for all, is a British Asian. Her name is Priti Patel, whose Gujarati family came to the UK from Uganda. She looks into the camera and smiles. I can't tell you how chilling I find that smile.
We stand for the law-abiding majority and not the criminal minority.
It's not that it's surprising to find a right-wing South Asian. It's the placid way that she seems to have disconnected herself from her own family history, from the forces that made her. She wants you to know that despite her brown skin, she's no cosmopolitan, but a salt-of-the-earth child of immigrants, happy to pull the ladder up after herself.
We will get Brexit done and deliver on the people's priorities. Thank you.
Hail and welcome.
The sun is finally rising at Stonehenge, though it's cloudy, so we don't get the full cosmic experience.
May there be peace in the east.
People are doing personal rituals around the stones, burning incense, tapping finger symbols, or quietly praying. The sweet smell of weed lingers in the air. Someone, to my surprise, has raised a Palestinian flag. I thought that people who were interested in ancestral wisdom might also be nationalists, people who voted for Brexit, who wanted fewer foreigners on ancient English soil. My plan was to tackle this head on, to ask people whether it mattered to them that their stone-raising ancestors might not be their ancestors at all. But when it comes to it, it feels rude to harsh the vibe.
Hail and welcome. Hail and welcome.
Flow through our emotions and wash away our fears until we feel at peace with who we truly are. So mote it be.
So mote it be.
What I hear later from pretty much everyone I talk to is that they consider the stones a universal place, a place for everyone. The crowd celebrating the equinox at Stonehenge don't have much time for captains and kings. They're more than happy to share a swig of mead or a joint, or to offer a little Reiki healing to anyone passing by. The Neolithic farmers who built the great monument may not have known the cosmic secrets of the universe, and they may not have left a genetic legacy in the bodies of the worshippers or the police standing to one side. They passed through and left something behind.
May there be peace throughout the whole world.
May there be peace throughout the whole world.
So much it be.
So much it be.
Time to leave Stonehenge, to leave druids and peace and the equal balance of day and night. Time to leave Essex Man and Messy Genetics. It's time to go to Virginia.
Everything was stitched into the fates, Harry. You know, nothing. There's nothing by chance.
Whiskey and some very old records and a little bit of twang. That's next time on Into the Zone. Into the Zone is produced by Ryder Alsop and Hunter Braithwaite. Our editor is Julia Barton. Mia LaBelle is our executive producer. Martin Gonzalez is our engineer. Music and theme song for this episode composed by Sarah K. Pedinotti, also known as Lip Talk. Thanks to our UK producers, Kate Ellis and William Warren. Special thanks to Jacob Weisberg, Heather Fain, John Schnars, Maya Koenig, Carly Migliori, Eric Sandler, Emily Rostick, and Maggie Taylor. Into the Zone is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider letting others know. The best way to do this is by rating us on Apple Podcasts. You could even write a review. And for a Spotify playlist of songs that inspired this episode, you can find me on Twitter at Harry Kunzru. See you next time.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.